Hi there, it's Matt here, and welcome back to the podcast, The Snooze Button. Is the snooze button a blessing or a curse? First, I think it's important to point out, by the way, that no other species demonstrates this unnatural act of prematurely and artificially terminating their sleep with some kind of an alarm device. In interviews or when I'm speaking with the public, I've often found it hard to entertain two essentially oppositional concepts. The first is the notion of how useful a regular wake-up time is. And of course, to accomplish that, most of us have to use an alarm clock. Yet on the other hand, in contrast, is the concern about being so aggressively terminated and jettisoned out of sleep. And in fact, coming back to the former in favor of not using alarm clocks and snooze buttons, when people often ask me, how do I know if I'm getting enough sleep? And I often reply, if your alarm didn't go off in the morning, would you sleep past that time? And if the answer is yes, then you may indeed not be getting enough sleep, at least enough defined as your own innate, what we call homeostatic drive for a certain amount of sleep. And you may ask, by the way, why have I offered cautionary tales about the use of alarm clocks? And I wrote about this a little bit in my book and also have spoken publicly about it before. Well, if you compare the physiological state of your body after being loudly awakened by an alarm relative to the physiological state of your body after naturally waking up from sleep, those two body states look very different. And there was a fantastic study a few years ago, I'm dating myself, I think it was back in 2005, by Professor Hori and colleagues out in Japan. It was a great study. And in the study, their participants were artificially awakened from their sleep experience. And they compared that to the participants being able to naturally wake up without an alarm. And what they found was that with that alarm instance, there was a very acute spike in blood pressure and an acceleration of the heart caused by a bursting activity of the fight or flight branch of the nervous system. And you can imagine that, let's say you use an alarm clock at least 5 days a week for your work. Think about repeating that process over and over again, which then brings us on to the snooze button, which you could argue almost amplifies that situation, because not only are you using a singular wake-up alarm event in the morning, resulting in those cardiovascular changes, but you're doing it multiple times. And a second point of cautionary, it's just a cautionary note that I have offered about shying away from using a snooze button, is that the structure of your remaining sleep is now unnatural, meaning that when you are using a snooze button, you stay in these lighter shallows of sleep rather than completing and going forward with the natural cycle of sleep that you're in. On the other hand, we know that one of the best ways to optimize your sleep, and it's also used, by the way, in insomnia patients, and we've spoken about this before, is regularity, going to bed at the same time and waking up at the same time. And for that, I usually recommend two alarm events. One, a to-bed alarm, getting you into bed at the regular time, and then a wake-up alarm. And so you can see that even I'm conflicted by this. There are two opposing forces here that I'm trying to juggle. Now, in truth, I have really just conflated two factors. One of them is the use of a singular alarm in the morning versus the use of the snooze button, which normally means that you're waking up at least twice, if not multiple times. And in general, I've typically not been the biggest fan of the snooze button. But a recent study that I want to tell you about has started to perhaps change my mind about that potential detrimental influence of using a snooze button. And I do love that notion of when data changes your mind and allows you to adopt a different viewpoint. And the study was performed by my friend and brilliant scientist, Dr. Tina Sunderland, together with her colleagues Shane Landry and the legend who is Dr. John Axelson. Their question was simple. Is using the snooze button detrimental to the health of our body and the cognitive faculties of our mind or even our mood states? And indeed, they even proposed that using the snooze button could be helpful rather than harmful. And that, if they demonstrated it, would be rather contrary to popular belief and certainly help me update my own mental framework. A sponsor of today's show is Inside Tracker, which is a service that comes out to your home and they will analyze your blood and your DNA to know precisely what is going on inside of you, hence the name Inside Tracker. They look at your blood, your metabolic signals, your hormonal health metrics, and then they give you a personalized, actionable set of lifestyle changes in response to that readout. And the goal there is to improve your health. I was looking and informed they have some new cardiovascular and new hormonal biomarkers that I'm particularly interested in. One that I'm focused on is something called ApoB, which is an absolutely critical heart health measure. And I get it done now with them somewhere between 4 to 6 times a year. Why? Well, my family, unfortunately, has a strong history of cardiovascular disease, so I am checking that pretty ruthlessly. And by the way, I do buy the product myself out of pocket. I don't want to fall prey to any of those trappings and undue incentives. Although, with full admission, I still use my own discount code that you can use to get some money off. And that code for you is insidetracker.com/Matt Walker. So just go over to insidetracker.com/Matt Walker. And again, if you want to get that discount, it is insidetracker.com/Matt Walker. Thanks very much. By the way, parenthetically, have you ever wondered where the alarm clock came from? Because it's a relatively modern invention, but you may not know its origins. And we believe the inception story of the alarm clock goes back to the Industrial Revolution, because there, with the emergence of large factories, came a challenge. How do you guarantee the en masse arrival of a large workforce at exactly the same singular time? In other words, at the start of the shift. Well, the solution in the town became the factory whistle, which was arguably the earliest and certainly the loudest version of an alarm clock. And that factory whistle skrill across the working village aimed to firstly wrench large numbers of individuals from their sleep, and then the second whistle would instigate the signaling or the beginning of the work shift. And so later, this invasive messenger of wakefulness entered the bedroom in the form of the modern day alarm clock. Gosh, I find that stuff so fascinating, but I'm drifting here once again. Focus, Matthew. These people are in a rush and they don't care for your professional or professorial BS. Anyway, coming back to the study, Sunderland and her team created 2 separate studies, each with a unique flavor of inquiry. The first study served almost as a probing lens into the waking habits of a vast populace, and it actually painted a really quite vivid picture. The second study then transitioned from the observational to the experimental. And here, they were venturing into the controlled environment of the laboratory to examine whether or not the snooze button had any impacts on cognitive performance or mood, or even certain metrics within the body. And here, they were focused on levels of cortisol, that stress-related chemical. Was the snooze button, therefore, bad for us? Or did it simply do no harm? Or was it even beneficial? Let's take the first study. Study 1 is what we call a basic observational study. And what I mean by that is the scientists are not performing any manipulation. They're simply observing certain metrics in a population. And so here, the scientists observed and analyzed data from 1,732 respondents. And they were doing that to try to understand what the characteristics of snoozing were and how the snooze button actually fit in to their morning routine. And they used a comprehensive questionnaire to understand the waking habits of those individuals. And what they found was that snoozing was, firstly, highly common throughout the population. What was also interesting is that it was more common in two groups. Firstly, younger individuals used the snooze button with a higher frequency than older individuals. Second, those people who were night owls, or what we call later chronotypes, and we've spoken about chronotypes before on this show, those night owls, or those evening types, were significantly more likely to use a snooze button than the morning types. And that, obviously, is very logical. So at that point, the researchers knew much more about the basic characteristics of snooze button use. Next, it was time to take it to the laboratory. And here, a detailed examination. And that brings us on to study 2. Study 2 was conducted, as I said, within the controlled laboratory setting. And here they recruited a smaller number of individuals. They recruited 31 habitual snoozers. And what they wanted to examine is the impact of the end period of their sleep, and specifically the last 30 minutes, and using a snooze button for those last 30 minutes, compared to a condition with just a singular awakening at the end of that sleep period. Now, I said that they wanted to measure the impact, quote unquote. How did they measure that impact? Well, mostly they focused on brain function and specifically cognitive performance. But as I said, they also took a peek at different aspects of their mood, and they also measured a metric within the body, specifically the stress-related chemical called cortisol. And I'll come back to the cortisol in just a little while. But before we speak about any of the impact on the outcome measures on the brain and also the body, let's start with exactly what the snooze button activity did on the sleep itself. What they found was that implementing a snooze button resulted in approximately 20% less total sleep in that last period. Now, that's probably no surprise. They're using a snooze button to wake them up in that last 30 minutes, so presumably, of course, they're going to get less sleep. And by the way, 20% does sound non-trivial, but keep that in context. It's across a 30-minute period, which really only equates to 6 minutes of lost sleep. And then came the first surprise. When they looked at the outcome measure of cortisol, and specifically the cortisol awakening response, which is often associated with stress, and as I said, that cortisol spike can be related to those accelerations in heart rate and spiking blood pressure from the study that I described earlier by Hori and colleagues. Instead, Sunderland and her team found no clear alterations in cortisol associated with repeated snoozing. They also didn't find any detrimental impact upstairs within the brain. There was no significant impact on the aspects of cognitive function that they measured. There was also no impact on the aspects of mood that they measured. Even their levels of sleepiness were not different after waking up. In fact, if anything, they were suggesting that perhaps some aspects of cognitive brain function upon awakening were better after using the snooze button relative to not using the snooze button. But here, their findings and their logic make a huge amount of sense. Remember that I said that those individuals were sleeping less? And yes, they were sleeping less. And it goes back to the start of the podcast where I told you one of the reasons that I'm not a big fan of a snooze button is that using a snooze button ends up keeping you in more shallow sleep and not letting you complete some of those other deeper stages of sleep in your natural cycle. And in fact, that's exactly what they found. Those individuals not only had a reduction in their sleep, but they were identifying more shallow sleep. And you'll remember a podcast that I did just a little while ago called The Art of Napping. And there I said, aim for a nap, ideally, of around about 20 minutes if you don't want to suffer from what we call sleep inertia, or that sort of sleep hangover effect, as some people call it. Why? Because if you nap any longer than that 20 minutes, it means typically that you're going to go into the deeper stages of sleep. And if you do, then when you wake up from that deeper sleep, you get that grogginess, that sluggishness of sleep inertia. And it can just take a little bit longer to wake up from and start functioning optimally. By the way, I also did tell you that longer naps also give even greater benefits. So you can trade that in. You can say, I don't mind the initial sleep inertia because I get greater benefits. But that's an aside. What Sunderland and her colleagues were showing is that perhaps one of the quote-unquote benefits of using the snooze button is that you will be waking up from more shallow sleep. And presumably, as a consequence of waking up from that lighter, more shallow sleep, you will not suffer as much sleep inertia upon awakening relative to if you had not been using the snooze button. Isn't that interesting? I should note, by the way, that the study does have limitations, like all great studies, and it was a fantastic study. My goodness, all of my published studies have so many limitations. But it does leave open some possibilities about snoozing, and those possibilities could still be detrimental. For example, not all different aspects of cognition within the brain were tested. Also, there are different aspects of mood and emotional and mental health that were not assessed. And so we don't have a full suite, a full kaleidoscope assessment of brain function. In addition, other body systems were not quantified. So, for example, does snoozing impact your body's blood sugar levels? Or does it change your appetite-regulating hormones? Or does it weaken your immune system? Or does it even alter reproductive hormones such as testosterone or estrogen? But let's do a thought experiment. Let's just say that they did measure all of those things. And still, there were no changes, no detriments to any of those metrics caused by snoozing. Surely that would be case closed and essentially all clear on the Western snooze front, as it were. Well, not quite either, because an alternative view could be, it's probably a little bit like the hyperbolic analogy of mild radiation exposure. If you expose someone to a modest or small amount of radiation one night and then measure the impact on the brain and the body the next day, perhaps you don't see anything in that one-shot assessment. But what if you keep exposing them to that very modest amount of radiation every night, 7 nights a week, for 28 to 30 days a month? Because if we go back to that 20% of lost sleep caused by snoozing, or just 6 minutes in total, if you actually add that up, it tallies up to somewhere between, if I'm doing my mathematics right, about 170 to 180 minutes, or about 3 hours of lost sleep by the end of the month. So in our thought experiment, if you instead assessed those individuals at the end of the month or after 1 month of this snooze implementation, rather than just after one single night, now would you see an impact on health, brain, and body? And if you did, would that change your opinion? I should say that it is still entirely possible that the answer to that longitudinal study design question would still be no when it comes to snoozing, and snoozing is entirely benign. But we don't know, so it could also be yes. This podcast is supported by Athletic Greens, which is now known as AG1. AG1 is a comprehensive nutritional drink that contains countless key health components. Actually, let me stop there. I say countless, but I actually know the company. I know how the product is made. And I believe at last count, it's over 75 different vitamins, minerals, probiotics, prebiotics, and other whole food nutrient sources. I do drink AG1 every day for the record. And also for the record, I buy my own supply because of all of the obvious integrity trappings that come with the free product. I know the company well, I know how the product is made, and I genuinely trust in their manufacturing. They are registered and approved by the Therapeutic Goods Administration. They also have GMP stamps, which means Good Manufacturing Practice badges. Basically, they're rigorous. So if you'd like to pick up an offer and get some money off your first order, and also get some free travel packs, just go to the link drinkag1.com/Matt Walker. So that's drinkag1.com/Matt Walker. And you will get some money off your purchase. So again, last time, that is drinkag1.com/Matt Walker. In truth, I do also use my own link to try and get some money off. I do buy it myself, but I do use the link to get that code money off too. And you can use that link as well. Thanks very much. Goodness, that all went a little bit dark and depressing with the whole radiation thing. I'm sorry about that analogy. As payment, let me give you something a little bit more cheery, a sort of a parenthetical tangent, which gives you such an insight into my polluted mind and stream of consciousness. But one hobby of mine is to collect the most innovative, meaning the most utterly ludicrous and thoroughly deranged alarm clock designs that are out there. Why? I don't know. I think it's just a way of trying to catalog all of the epically depraved ways that we human beings wrench our brains out of sleep. One such alarm clock, I love this one. It contains a number of different geometric blocks that sit in complementary shaped holes on a square pad. And when the alarm goes off in the morning, not only does that alarm clock erupt with a truly heinous blurting shriek, it also explodes every one of those single geometric blocks across the floor of your bedroom. And the alarm will not shut off until you then get down on all fours and you hunt down each one of those geometric objects and you reposition them in their respective locations. But I think my favorite, in truth, is called the Shredder Alarm Clock. Honestly, I kid you not. This is a real thing. You can Google it if you want. Here's how it works. You take a money bill. Let's say it's a $20 bill, or in my parlance, my language, a 20-pound note. And then before you go to bed, you slide the money bill into the front of the alarm clock. And then when the alarm goes off the next morning, you have just a short amount of time to wake up and then turn off the complex alarm before it starts shredding your money in front of your blurry eyes. What are we doing as a species, people? But I think there's one that's perhaps even more cruel. This comes from the brilliant behavioral economist Dan Ariely. And he has suggested an alarm clock, which is essentially an app on your phone. And it's connected to the internet by Wi-Fi. And by way of that, it's actually connected not just to the internet, but more specifically to your bank account. And here's how it works. For every second that you remain asleep past the allotted alarm that goes off in the app, the clock will start to send $10 to an organization that you absolutely despise. And that organization, which you truly like, is one that you yourself have set up when maniacally programming the alarm clock to begin with. Utter genius. Anyway, let me finally get back to this study by the wonderful Tina Sunderland and her colleagues. It was a great study. It was very well conducted. The data is, I think, quite suggestive of minimal effects, at least on the things that they measured following essentially one night or one morning of a manipulation. And it really has me rethinking my previous scientific-based position. And I've honestly started to update my mental iOS beliefs about perhaps what was, I guess, largely exclusively a negative stance on using the snooze button. That said, I still feel, at least at this stage overall, that it's probably best to leave your body to do its own thing. Let it sleep in natural, unbroken ways, at least right to the point before your single alarm goes off. Which is to say that, at least personally, I'm probably not going to start using a snooze button right now. And by the way, that's, in truth, not the goal of their study. It wasn't their goal. They weren't trying to convince you of anything. They simply wanted to explore an empirical question. And they did that wonderfully. Tina, if you are listening out there, yet another outstanding study. And with that, folks, I will simply say good night. Take care. Thank you so much for tuning in. I will see you next time.